of 10:15 having arrived, I will call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. Just a little changing in the agenda today. We're going to go with House File 1994 first, so we'll take the testimony and so forth. And members, this was the bill that we weren't able to hear at our last meeting, and I had said that this would be the first bill up for this meeting. So you'll notice on the schedule we're not quite there, but we will go with House File 1994 first. Chair Carlson, when we have a quorum, you'll move the bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. But if you could please present your bill, and I believe you have one witness. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of or concerns on House File 1994? And we do have an amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and we'll have to wait for quorum, I guess, to adopt the amendment. But if it's all right with you, we'll explain the bill.
Why don't we, Mr. Chairman, why don't we explain the bill as amended?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Chair Carlson.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, you know, I kind of like to do a little research. I didn't get a chance to think or to find out what important events may have taken place in 1994. People still talk about one of my bills that I did a little research on, 1812, a number of years ago. I don't know if you were here for that one.
I think there's a battle that year, wasn't there?
There was, yeah. Okay. And there was an overture as well.
Okay.
But, so I'll have to do some research on 1994.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chairman, just by way of background, I had before the committee a bill dealing with sales tax exemption for certain athletic groups, and at that time we had testimony from the department expressing some concern, sort of I would describe as gentle concern, about the fact that maybe we were looking at things a little bit piecemeal. That was the one dealing with Olympic training and so on. And also Susan Brown testified at the time about an interest in expanding the sales tax exemption to include nonprofits. And as a result of that, Mr. Chairman, as you know, then a bill was drafted and now an amendment prepared to expand it to include other nonprofits. So as proposed to be amended, the bill would expand nonprofit organizations to include types of 501c3 organizations that do not currently qualify for the exemption, including literary and scientific organizations. And Mr. Chairman, if you take a look at the fiscal note, because the other day we did have some discussion about what the approximate cost would be, and at that point, I think it was pretty much ballpark when Ms. Brown came forward. But the fiscal note would show that if we do expand the exemptions to include those 501c3s under the Internal Revenue Code, that would be about $3.4 million the first year, because it's a partial year, and $3.8 million the second year. And then in the out biennium, $3.9 million and $4 million. So that would be the fiscal impact of expanding it. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll request that Ms. Brown continue her testimony, perhaps, that she started the other day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Members, you should have the revenue note in your packets. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We're a statewide membership organization of nonprofit organizations in Minnesota. We appreciate Representative Carlson bringing this forward, as he mentioned, as something that we raised in response to his bill related to the pentathlon Olympic athletes. And we agree with the Department of Revenue that a piecemeal approach to granting the sales tax exemption for 501c3s doesn't make great sense as we see it, and we'd prefer to see the exemption expanded to all 501c3s. Currently, 501c3 organizations are income tax exempt, and they apply to the federal government for that, but the sales tax exemption, which, just to clarify, is for the purchase of items and the tax paid on the purchase of items. It doesn't have to do with the sales tax that's sometimes collected by nonprofits. The sales tax exemption is provided by the state of Minnesota to a more limited group than those who get the income tax exemption through their 501c3 status. In the House research bill summary, it's nicely laid out that the types of organizations that are currently not provided the sales tax exemption in the state of Minnesota are scientific, literary, testing for public safety, fostering national and international amateur sports competitions, that's the previous bill we heard, and preventing cruelty to children and animals. And I believe there's also a bill that has been circulating related to animal welfare organizations. We believe that if this was expanded to include all 501c3s, that it would provide equitable sales tax exemption for the nonprofit sector, as well as clarity and simplicity both for organizations and for the Department of Revenue.
Thank you. Thanks. Questions from members? And again, anyone in the audience that's just arrived that wishes to testify on behalf of House File 1994 as it will be amended or with concerns? Would the department like to testify?
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Thank you.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to committee, sir.
I wanted to just reiterate that when we testified before on the smaller bill, that we didn't necessarily have a concern, but we did want to illuminate that this was a symptom of a larger problem. The bill before you today really does help to provide some clarity in a very murky part of the tax code, and especially related for purchases by nonprofits. So wanted to thank Representative Carlson as it relates to this bill for the clarity it would provide to both the Department of Revenue and to taxpayers who are trying to navigate this system. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for members for Mr. Cummins? Okay, with that, members, we do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. We can't move the minutes yet until Representative Simonson gets here. And so Chair Carlson moves House File 1994. Chair Carlson moves the DE1, the H1994 DE1 amendment. Any questions for members? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes barely. With that, we now have House File 1994 as amended. Any questions from members? Chair Carlson moves that House File 1994 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you so much,
Thank
Chair
you, Mr.
Carlson.
Chairman.
Item next, we have a CRESIA bill, and we can't do the minutes yet. Okay, CRESIA, House File 438. I will move the CRESIA bill. And I do not see any amendments. So, Representative Cresha, if you could please present your bill, and then I believe that you have a testifier that will be coming up other than Mr. Cassidy also. Is that correct, Mr. Altman? Does that sound right? Okay. And then just to see here, is there anyone else other than Mr. Cassidy, Mr. Altman, that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? And then would the department like to testify on this bill? We'll see if they come back. I don't see the department here right now. Okay, welcome, committee. We have House File 438 before us. Please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. House File 438 is really about spurring economic growth and trying to focus dollars in a way that we can get more return on those rather than just simply seeing those go out the door with no return. I'm here before you today with 438. This bill creates a Minnesota new tax credits, new markets tax credit program based off the highly competitive federal program. The federal program was enacted by Congress in 2000 as a bipartisan effort to support private investment in certain communities. Between 2003 and 2012, $31 billion in private capital was invested and created approximately 750,000 jobs at a cost to the federal government of less than $20,000 per job. But the demand is far greater. For the current application round, the Treasury Department has received nearly $20 billion of application for $3.5 billion of investment authority. This high demand for new markets tax credit is why 14 other states have adopted similar programs. that support private investment in low-income communities. And I have a whole four other paragraphs that I'll summarize very quickly and just say what this bill does, members, is this allows us to take funds and direct them to those communities which we think can benefit the most. We could either send these dollars away and hope they come back, or we can help target those and know that they're going to grow communities and grow jobs in areas around the state. And with that, I know we have a number of testifiers who are much more versed in this. I'm just simply going to put this out and say, in all the economic development that I've done, in all the community building I've worked in all the education, this is the type of program that makes a difference. This is the type of program that gets in and sustainably builds out jobs and helps grow. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome, committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Stinson Leonard Street. Here on behalf of Enhanced Capital, who is our client that participates in the New Markets Tax Credit Program, both on the federal level and in a number of states around the country. I believe there's now 14 states that have adopted their own program.
Welcome to the committee.
Representative Creech has done a good job at capturing the essence of this program. What I'd like to point out is that this program was created, I believe, over 20 years ago at the federal level. It's been very successful. States have had to fight for allocations at the federal level, and a lot of those states have decided, why don't we just create our own fund on the state level? That's why we're here today, to create a pool of dollars under this proposal, $250 million of capital. $250 million of capital that has to be deployed within the first 12 months of the program. The tax credits are delayed over 7 years. The first 2 years, there's no payout of tax credits. After that, they're measured. If I could point out a couple things for you in your packet, this brochure right here. On the back, you'll see a timeline of how the $39 million and $97 million in tax credits are paid out. That's a 39% tax credit over the course of 7 years. And if I could also point out on page two how this program works with the creation of the CDEs, the certification, the fact that they have to have been certified and been participating in the federal program, which is the oversight by the United States Department of Treasury. And then on the state level, DEED would be the regulatory authority overseeing this program. Third, there's also some maps in your packet. I believe you have a state map and maybe a metro map. The blue areas are the areas in which you can participate in this in the New Markets Tax Credit Program. You'll see a lot of yellow. Those are areas that areas which cannot participate in the program. If you'd like, we can get you district by district maps as well and show where the blue areas where you can participate in the program in your legislative districts. With that, I will stand for questions, and I think we have one more testifier as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Cassidy from members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just still trying to understand kind of how this program differs from the current federal one and what flexibility we have in terms of designing the state one. If you could give us a little background about how this might be different in terms of who qualifies, any of the other differences in terms of the state proposal before us.
Ms. Manzi, could you maybe help us out on, or Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, the way the bill is drafted, it would require businesses that ultimately get the benefit of this to meet the federal requirements, but then it imposes some additional requirements to target it to what I think the thought is that are more high growth type businesses, so that it would not be used for, you know, just a real estate type development. I'm trying to find the definition of the qualified. Yeah, I got to find it in the bill. It's if you look on page two. The bottom of page 2, subdivision 9, that's the definition of a qualified low-income community business, which are the ultimate beneficiaries of this. There's a fairly complicated infrastructure that provides for the flow of funds to those entities that mirrors what the federal government does. But it's that description of what a qualified active low-income community business is. And it's narrower than what the federal is, because the federal is fairly open-ended. That's basically any business that's operating in a low-income community and meets some other requirements pretty much qualifies.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's really helpful. Mr. Michael, is that the main difference then between us and the federal provisions?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes, that's right. Otherwise, the process, other than the fact that the state is funding it, is really mirrors what the federal is. Now, the federal differs also in that they score applications. So the applications come in, and they have a group of people in the Treasury Department that score applications. If I recall right, I have to keep in mind that there are two different bills. I believe this is done on a first-come, first-served basis. And not done on a scoring basis. And obviously the scoring would involve a lot more fiscal cost, than you'd have to think about what kind of criteria you want to set up in the statute that would say we're going to favor, you know, this application over that application and so forth. And this sort of goes more along the lines of what's done with the angel credit, where, you know, whoever comes in first with a qualified application gets the money if there's still money that's available in the account.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kreisha, the one difference that was highlighted actually was an area of concern for me in terms of your having narrowed the qualifying businesses. If you look at what most low-income neighborhoods are or communities, they often are represented by a lot of single-parent households and are really, you know, but the reason why we'd invest in them is because we want to get good-paying jobs into those communities. But the particular businesses that you've selected to narrowly be able to apply for this in Minnesota are actually all male-dominated industries. The manufacturing, mining, forestry, and the high technology fields as defined under the Angel Investment Tax Credit tend to be also, unfortunately, still male-dominated. And so I'm wondering if there was a reason that you chose these without looking to a broader range of potential businesses that could qualify, that would also offer higher incomes, but also have a broader range of potential participants that would benefit from the occupational investments.
Representative Kreisha.
And thank you for the question. Thank you, Representative Loeffler and Mr. Chair members. I did not design this bill on demographics. I designed it on industries, and where I work in economic development, high tech is high tech. It's growing out of people's bedrooms. It's growing out of their living rooms as they emerge from this, and this is across the cross-section. I've worked with many male and females who are growing businesses, and I did not design that to be in those demographics. If you saw that, and if there's a way we can tailor that, we can talk about that. But these are the industries of most need, and these are the industries that are growing around the state. One of the fallacies that people fall into in economic development is that we have to build these huge Fortune 500 companies. The fact of the matter is our jobs are growing in these 5 to 10 people communities, our businesses. And many of these are very, very intelligent women. In fact, I've worked with some high-tech companies that are far outpacing some of their male counterparts. But I think we have to give them the ability. I don't think we can just lay down and say this is a male-dominated or female. Let's make the grounds fertile, and let's let them enter the field and take part in this as anybody else. I don't believe there's anything in here that precludes women from coming in and being strong in these fields either.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, you know, the high-tech industry, I think, has been, you know, reported to be, you know, very successful, and it has been for some people, but I think that the crash rate is just as high as it is in any other kind of startup area, and so I think we need to, I like the idea that the federal government has some ratings, and it's not just first come, first served, and did you think at all about that in terms of making sure that the best proposals rise to the top here in the process if we were to start a state program?
And thank you, and that helps. That clarifies it. Yes, we actually went back and forth between the rating system and the first come first serve, and it's not first come first serve in the sense that whoever applies wins. You have to meet the qualifications. You have to hit the benchmark. So first of all, you've already made it to the pool, and we can talk about this. But if you start to do scoring, you introduce the element of subjectivity. You introduce the element of no longer looking at the qualifications of a business. You start to look at other factors that may or may not prove to be successful as that business tries to make its run. So I believe the best thing you do is you set up an objective rubric, and you say if you can get in and you can make it to the cut, then we start to go down. I mean, how much more objective can you be than I've done my homework, I've got my business ready to go, and I've made my application, rather than, well, I turn my application and I hope somebody makes the right decision. So that's when I weighed both sides of this. I see the pros and cons. I really think that when you start into the scoring rubrics, you end up with gerrymandering. You end up with a possibility of tailoring this away from the objectives of allowing businesses to compete on the merits of what they've put together.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just say that because of the mix of businesses that you've chosen to select, and a business like the mining industry is very heavily organized. It has lobbyists. It'll know what's passed the legislature. That may not be true of the startup high-tech business of a computer programmer or a software designer or a biotech who's just come out of grad school at the U and who doesn't have that kind of infrastructure to know. And so having a longer period of time to apply, a broader outreach by the state might bring in some of those businesses that you're targeting and give them an equal opportunity to compete. So I personally prefer a competitive approach.
Just one quick comment. I think with the recent layoffs in the MinTac and what the Iron Range is going through, I think they would be very inviting of this program.
Okay, let's. We will open it. Any more questions for Mr. Cassidy? Questions for members? And, Representative Kreischer, you said businesses starting in bedrooms. Could we maybe let the record reflect you meant garages?
Garages, living rooms, yes. I'm sorry. Okay. I probably meant basements, Mr. Chair.
Home offices. Yeah, you're kind of scaring me there. Okay, please come down, Mr. Altman. Now, what I have, and I see Mr. Cummings left the room again here. I don't know if the department wishes to testify on this bill. But we'll certainly give them the option. They don't? No? Okay. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Frank Altman, and I'm president and CEO of Community Reinvestment Fund. We are a 26-year-old nonprofit headquartered in Minneapolis that is a major user of the federal New Market Tax Credits. We are working together with a coalition of other nonprofit community development financial institutions in Minnesota that combined have used more than almost $2 billion worth of federal credits over the last 12 years. So we are very familiar with this program and at the federal level, and we commend Representative Kreischer and efforts in this committee to bring the credit to Minnesota as a state credit. We are supporting Senator Albright's bill, which I believe will be heard later by the committee, and there are a few differences in the bill that we're trying to work out between the two parties so that we can come up with the most effective bill that will permit the widest range of both investors and job-creating business opportunities throughout the state. The Federal New Markets Credit is a very effective program that has a lot of flexibility in it that allows businesses in neighborhoods as well as manufacturers and others to get access to credits that are necessary that if they were not involved in that financing, that financing would not occur. Most of the credits at the federal level have been made to operating businesses that have real estate as a component of their operations. They might be building a plant, adding on to a plant, not just buying equipment. So we think it's important that real estate as collateral be something that is available in this credit in Minnesota, and are working on that in a number of other areas as well. Finally, I'd say that we think that it's important to have the widest range of investors involved, and the bill before you today is focused on the premium tax as the source of the tax that would be credited. We believe the premium tax ought to be included, but we believe also a business income tax ought to be part of this effort as well, so that we have the widest range of investors seeking the credits and bringing the credit value to the end business up to the highest level possible. So we are working, we hope by the end of the week that we'll have some areas of commonality that we can bring back to you between the two bills and have a bill that will work effectively across the state of Minnesota. And with that, I'll stop and answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Altman. Any questions for Mr. Altman? Anyone else wish to testify on the bill? Then I will renew my motion that House File 438 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Kreischer. and to the testifiers. Item next, we're going to do a little administrative work here. And maybe Chair Gunther could join us here at the table. I was kind of worried we wouldn't be able to finish this off here today, but Representative Simonson moves the minutes from the March 26th meeting. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I'm going to, members, recall to bring back before the committee the minutes from January 20th, and I need to make a couple corrections there. So I will move to bring the minutes back before us from January 20th, and I'll explain what we're doing here. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Members, on the minutes from June 20th, and we'll just, excuse me, what did I say?
January
20th. January 20th.
Not
sure. The original minutes said that Representative Davids moved House File 63. That should have been Representative Anderson S. So that'd be one correction that I'd like to make, and I missed this before. And then the third line up from the bottom, it says Representative Davids moved House File 63 as amended to be laid over. It should have been Representative Anderson S. And the third issue is we amended the bill, and it should read in the corrected version, it says Representative Anderson S. moved that the H0063A2 amendment be adopted. The motion prevailed. The amendment did leave or is in the on the bill in the committee, but the minutes don't reflect that. So any questions for members on that to correct the minutes? Representative Anderson S.
Mr. Chair, wasn't it Representative Simonson that actually amended the bill? Or was that a different bill? Okay.
Different bill. Right. Okay. So the three changes would be Representative Anderson S. moved that HF 63 come before the committee. And then Representative Anderson has moved that House File 63 is amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, tax bill. And it should read Representative Anderson has moved that the H0063A2 amendment be adopted. And it says the motion prevailed. Any discussion? Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it was you who renewed the Anderson S. motion, so you could make it read that way. You renewed her motion, as I recall.
What memory?
Chair Lucheski.
Mr. Chair, did your caucus or your side of the aisle spend the break listening to the tapes?
I was up till about 2 this morning. Actually, I think we went back and listened to the tape, or staff listened to the tapes, and it was Anderson S. that apparently moved the bill. So we can take another look at it. I just want these to be correct. Everything is where we need it except the minutes. Chair Lanchester.
Genuinely, though, Mr. Chair, and I know it's really important always to get everything right for the record and have it line up with the tapes, and I know your staff does a great job of getting everything upstairs for all time and archived. Did this come up because somebody was listening to the tapes and there was something wrong? I just find it hard to believe that everyone spent their break thinking about what happened on January 20th.
Well, our staff does that.
Okay.
So,
and so
it wasn't me.
Mr. Chair, if it's just bound by staff, you know, I think we could just direct the staff to get it in the order that they hear it on the tape, and we can just amend that now.
And so that'll be the motion. The staff corrected accordingly for January 30th provisions that I mentioned. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, and that was not Representative Simonson's fault. He did originally move the minutes, I believe, but I didn't catch it. So I apologize, Representative Simonson, for my error. Okay. No, I don't apologize on here. Last time I apologized, I got in a lot of trouble, so I don't apologize for the record. Okay. I will move. That is good. That is good. Okay. I welcome the committee, Chair Gunther. I will move the House File 519. I will move the bill. And then to get the bill in the order the Chair Gunther would like, I'll move the H0519A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now we have the bill as amended in the order the author would like. Chair Gunther, if you could please describe or present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. House File 519 increases the amount of tax credits available under Minnesota Angel tax credit for qualified investors to $17 million from the current level of $15 million. By increasing our investments in angel investment tax credits, we can continue to encourage job creation and economic growth across the state of Minnesota. And with that, I would like to introduce one of my testifiers, John Dukic.
Very good.
Minnesota High Tech Association.
Please state your name and who represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association. I'll keep my testimony brief. We support this bill and see it as a way to encourage investment in our startups across the state. And, in fact, we have someone, an entrepreneur here, who can share his experience with the Angel Investor Tax Credit.
Thank you, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chad Olson. I'm the CEO of BuyMe.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I'll be semi-brief, too. I recognize some familiar faces, so it's good to see you all again. But the one thing I'd like to share with you is some progress of what's been going on with my real business since the first time I testified here. In short, BuyMe, which is my company, is a mobile app meant for college students that lets them get exclusive discounts from local merchants. It's very similar to what Groupon is, but exclusive to young college students. As of late, I just raised another $250,000 from a local investor and received the angel tax credit to help out with the investor. I cannot express how thankful I am for this plan and system. And with that being said, with the money that I received for my company, I am directly putting it right back into other local businesses to help build my business, expand the development of the app. And we are looking to expand across the country. My one update that I have for everyone with my business is that I've been doing some research. This is a little R&D on my end, but I've been doing research on other competitors, and the next closest guy that's doing anything that we're attempting to do is in Palo Alto. Go figure. But the one thing that I'm very proud and excited to share with you all is that the Angel Tax Credit has been able to help me take my business to the next level with development firms and, well, of course, my favorite, the legal bills and everything else like that. But that's pretty amazing to say that the next guy and next player in my field that I'm going into is in Palo Alto, and I'm proud to say I'm from Minnesota, and that's largely in part to the Angel Tax Credit. So that being said, I strongly encourage this, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions or details about my business and how the Angel Tax Credit has helped my business flourish and expand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Before we go into member questions, I'd like to see if there's anyone else who wishes to testify on behalf of the Gunther bill with concerns. Would the department like to testify? No? Okay. Questions for members for Chair Gunther, Mr. Dukic, or Mr. Olson? Chair Earhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this the second time this year we've raised this, or where have I seen this before? Is that last year we did it? No.
I believe Chair Anderson S. had a bill. Mr. Michael, are we
is it
similar?
We have stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So well, what's the difference here, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Michael, what would the difference between the Anderson S. bill and the Gunther bill?
Mr. Chairman, $1
million. $1 million. So Chair Earhart?
Can I raise that? Are we on a bidding basis then?
Do I hear $2 million? Other questions? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 519 as amended be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Chair Gunther and Mr. Dukic and Mr. Olson. Item next, I will move House File 921, a Schumacher bill, and I do not see any amendments. Members, you have the revenue note in your packet. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chairman. If you could please, I've moved the bill, so it is before us. If you could please present your bill. And before we start, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, is there anyone who wishes to testify on behalf of this bill that's in the audience or with concerns? Would the department like to make any comments on this? No? Okay. Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 921 establishes a long-term care savings plan for Minnesotans. It's like a savings, health savings account, but without the need for a qualified health plan. It has the same objective as long-term care insurance without the need of a medical exam. Minnesotans should have the options as we age, to age in our own homes and receive the care of our choosing. The only way we can truly guarantee that this happens is if we take personal responsibility and invest in our own futures. Right now, though, there's really only one product on the market that incentivizes that planning, and that's long-term care insurance. Long-term care insurance works well for the people that qualify and can afford the premiums, but a study published by Boston University in November of last year pointed out that for most Americans, somewhere between 70 and 80%, the better plan is for them to spend down, go on Medicaid, and let the state decide for their care into the future. This long-term care savings plan adds another tool in the toolbox for Minnesotans to plan and save for themselves. Contributions to the plan would be tax-deductible from the state of up to $1,000 per year for a single filer and $2,000 for married joint filers. If the money saved is not used for long-term care costs, there is a 10% penalty applied. The maximum that an individual can contribute to the plan is $200,000 over their lifetime, and that cap is set to adjust with inflation. With that, members, I'll stand for questions.
Okay, so, Chair Schumacher, so this would be deductible at the state level but not at the federal level, is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Now, members, we have had some other bills regarding long-term care insurance, some different ideas. This is another idea that is before us. Questions for members for Chair Schumacher? Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Schumacher, is there an age parameter on this? For example, can one start this plan after age 65?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson. There is no time limit on when someone can start the plan. Distribution, though, I believe, is after age 50 is when you can start using.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair Erickson. Then, Representative Schumacher, then if it's age 50, there'd be a 10% penalty if someone withdrew the money before age 50?
Mr. Chair, if the costs were not related to long-term care.
And then that would, Mr. Chairman, that would be a penalty. Let me think here now.
10%, Mr. Chair.
It'd be a 10% penalty at the state level, but there'd be no federal penalty. Right? Okay. Okay, questions, Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And one thing, I was just the math I was trying to figure out is there's a $200,000 contribution limit, but you're only allowed to put $1,000 a year in and $2,000 if you're a married couple, so you'd have to start it with a birth gift or something to hit that. And I don't know if your intention was that you couldn't, with investments, get over $200,000 or if, you know, how we got to that math.
If you invest in my firm, you'd be there quite quickly. that was shameless, wasn't it? Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. The cap is only, the $1,000 contribution cap is only for the tax deductible portion. So you can put more, you can invest more into the savings account. You just don't get the tax incentive for it.
Representative Loeffler.
Okay, I wasn't, that wasn't clear to me that was, that you could put even more in. And then you presented this as an alternative to buying long-term care insurance, but then you sort of let people divert it into premiums for long-term care insurance. And it seems to me like we either want this product for people who are really froze out of that market because of health needs or other issues that just don't make them insurable within that market, or not, but I'm wondering why we would want to have people divert into an insurance product after they've been allowed to have a tax deduction here.
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. The idea isn't to only help the people who are frozen out of accessibility for those things. If long-term care insurance were to become something that the customers saw as advantageous for themselves later on, that they would have the option to do that with the premiums that they had saved or with the savings that they had already made. And so if down the line they want to make that, but we want to make it accessible to people who might not otherwise be able to at their current point afford the premiums and that sort of thing, so that they're able to invest something rather than a premium or nothing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And we already have a tax policy, a long-term care insurance premium tax credit. And so we've already, I think, addressed that. And I would actually be much more comfortable if we kept these as separate programs and separate vehicles. I think there's a it creates a different sort of marketing issue. And I think it also has just a different impact on our long-term care industry and how much people self-fund and how they do it. And I suspect this, you know, if it, like any tax break, it's those that have the greatest resources that usually can take advantage of that. But it seems to me that keeping this separate from our long-term care insurance tax credit might be a good policy.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. You know, as I read through this, Chair Schumacher, there's actually quite a bit of brilliance in this bill, if you think about it, because you could have someone, not that there isn't in all your bills, but if members would just consider this, you start out at age 25, 30, you start taking advantage of this plan, and you can't really afford a long-term care policy, you wouldn't meet the suitability requirements that the state lays out. So then as you work, you become more successful, you go from maybe lower middle class to maybe wherever you end up there.
Craig David's class?
Well, that'd be, well, yeah. That kind of has his own class, I guess. But that being said, what you could do then, as you would qualify, you build up more assets, your home's paid for, things you want to protect, then you would have this account where you could buy a long-term care policy, which would give you a lot more bang for the buck. And if it's a partnership plan, it would actually increase the spend-on amount. That's kind of cool, actually. Questions for members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're always good at figuring out how middle and upper middle-class people could take advantage of these things. But the reality, for those of us who serve on the Health and Human Services, and Representative Schumacher knows this very well, the reality is the majority of our seniors don't have hardly anything saved for their just basic costs of retirement. And I do have some concern that we, you know, not incent the market so much that people buy savings vehicles or create savings vehicles or long-term insurance policies until they have actually provided for their own retirement costs, like paying the utilities and the property tax bills and, you know, those kind of basic things. And so I think if we're really going to go into this kind of policy, we might want to look at trying to put some requirements in, like you have to have already taken advantage of, you know, IRA savings or other sorts of things, because we may end up with people who have a lot of resources set up for long-term care insurance needs, but in their 60s and 70s, long before they need that, they don't have the money they need to just basically live. And that's unfortunately a situation that many of the people that are in our state occur. And we've seen a lot of people dropping long-term care insurance policies because they can't afford the premiums, because they need that money for just the basics, the heat bill, the insurance bill, the co-pays on Medicare, whatever. And so I think it's good for us to incent people to plan for long-term care needs, but we really need to first make sure they're doing the basics, which is saving for retirement. And the people you're talking about would have done both. But we've never hit I think it's 40% of the people employed covered by either a private pension, a 401k, or any other employer-subsidized insurance program. So we've got a lot of people in Minnesota who really need to, out of their paycheck, save for the basics first, and then go to their needs for long-term care and other issues that they're going to potentially hit as well.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Mr. Michael, on the subdivision 4, on the penalty section there, okay, usually penalties are like up to 59.5, and after that there is no penalty, but it looks like this penalty sticks with us if it's not used for long-term care purposes. Okay. Other questions for members? With that, I will renew my motion that House File 921 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Item next, Now, members, we will, I mean, we don't have to rush through anything here. We will be leaving at about, I'll be adjourning by 11:40 today because we do have a 12 o'clock floor session, so I want to give members some time to get over there. So, but we do have a couple bills left here. I will move my bill, House File 2083. There are no amendments. I think Ms. Manzi, basically, members, we got 2083, 2084 there. Kind of down the same line, but there are some differences. So, Ms. Manzi, if you could describe House File 2083 for the committee, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 2083 provides an individual income tax subtraction for student loan principal payments made during the taxable year. Under current law, people can deduct student loan interest payments at the federal level, and that deduction flows through to the state level and is taken into account in determining state taxable income. This new deduction for student loan principal payments would be limited to the amount that had been deducted for interest payments, and that would have the impact of skewing the deduction towards people in the earlier years of their loans when they're paying off more interest than principal rather than in the later years of a loan when they're paying off more principal than interest, because they would be limited to the amount deducted for interest. And it also would have the effect of picking up the federal income-based phase-out for the student loan interest deduction for this state deduction for student loan principal payments. So the ability to claim the deduction would be phased out. For it would start to phase out if you were married joint filer when your income reached $130,000 of modified adjusted gross income, and then it would be fully phased out when it got to $160,000. And for all other filers, the phase out would start at $65,000 and end at $80,000. So that's, Mr. Chair, I think that describes the bill.
That's 2083. Is there anyone in the audience which testify on behalf of the bill? Anyone with concerns? The department? Okay. And in higher ed committee, I believe it was MPIRG, testified on behalf of this bill. They were supporting, I think, both of them, weren't they, Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct. They didn't have any handouts that I kept in my folder, so I can't say for sure.
Okay, okay. I was just taken aback a bit to have MPIRG support anything I've ever done in my life. So with that, so it's kind of fun, actually. And I don't think Nan Madden's against this one either. Is she? Nope, guess not. Okay, any discussion? Yes, Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This does not apply to graduate loans, just the undergraduate in higher ed, or would it be applicable to someone earning a graduate?
Ms. Manzi?
For which they received a loan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe it's both. It's any qualified education loan under the federal law. I can verify that and get back to you, but my understanding is that it would be both.
Yeah, on page 5, members, the top line, qualified education loan. So maybe Ms. Manzi could let the committee know what the definition of that is. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm intrigued by the, or interested in the phase-out provisions that Ms. Manzi touched on, and I'm wondering, I'm trying to remember how that relates to the income tax deciles, or the income deciles. From the tax incidence study, how high up the in the deciles are we getting in terms of where the phase out?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I think you're probably talking about population deciles rather than income deciles, which is what the tax incidence study addresses in the body of the report. It does have an appendix that uses income deciles. I think that this phase out for married couples, I think it would be in the either the 9th or the 10th decile. For single filers, it would be in a somewhat lower decile since it would start at $65,000. It's also an income measure that's a little bit narrower than the household income used in the tax incidence study.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Ms. Manzi, thank you for correcting me. You did understand the question that I asked poorly. It when we're providing income tax credits for folks who are in the highest decile. It's kind of striking. But thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Any other questions? With that, I'll move that House File 2083 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Item next, House File 2084. There are no amendments. Is there anyone, before we have Ms. Manzi go over it, is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns on the bill, the department? Okay. Ms. Manzi, this one works a little differently.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. This one would be a credit rather than a subtraction, so that's the first difference. It would apply to payments of principal and interest. The amount of the credit would be limited in three ways, so it would be the least of three things. And if you look in either the summary or the revenue estimate, there are bullet points listing the three things. So the first thing, which is really an income-based measure that sort of tries to get at the taxpayer's ability to pay, is that you would take the taxpayer's adjusted gross income and subtract from that $10,000, and then the credit would be limited to 10% of that amount over $10,000 to the extent that it matched what you actually paid in student loan principal and interest. So I'll give an example now that I said all those words, because the example seemed to help in the Higher Education Committee. So if, for instance, you paid $5,000 in student loan principal and interest during the year and you had adjusted gross income of $40,000, then you would subtract $10,000 from the $40,000, which gets you to $30,000, and then your maximum credit would be 10% of $30,000 of worth $3,000, and that would be your credit because you had actually paid $5,000, so you would get a $3,000 credit under the first bullet point. The second bullet point, you would have to then have earned income of at least $3,000 in this example to claim that $3,000 credit. And then the third bullet point makes it so it wouldn't work for somebody to just decide, wow, this credit is a good deal. I'm going to borrow money from my parents and my aunts and uncles and pay off all of my student loan at one time in order to get a huge credit before the legislature decides to repeal this. So this says that the maximum credit would be the interest portion of the payments that you made during the year plus 10% of the original loan amount, so sort of like the body of the loan. So that would keep you from making one giant payment in order to take advantage of the full amount of the credit in a year when you had, you know, income that was relatively low.
Well, Ms. Manzi, I can't imagine that this became law. A future legislature would ever want to repeal it. But
well, Mr. Chair, I don't know that they would, but a taxpayer might have that apprehension.
Just a bit of a safety net. Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps this is also to Ms. Mansby. I'm really impressed with the smarts of a lot of our young people. And so if you're just graduated from undergraduate school and you're going to graduate school, so your income is very little, and you get your parents or somebody, or you got a little savings, you got some nice money, cash, when you graduated from your undergraduate program, and so you paid off some of your loan. I mean, is there any way this can be used in a way that wasn't what the author intended in terms of helping a graduate student erase their undergraduate loans?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think that's probably where you run up against that second bullet point, because the amount of credit that you can claim is limited to your earnings during the year. So if you had someone who was a full-time graduate student and didn't have any earned income, they wouldn't be able to claim this credit at all, regardless of how much they had paid on their undergraduate loans. So they would have to have some kind of a job, either a wage job or self-employment income, in order to claim the credit.
Mr. Chair, almost every graduate student I know is working, and I didn't hear that the first bill had those same sort of protections either. I mean, and not that I wouldn't love to have people be able to get higher ed for free, but I don't know if we're quite at that point and maybe we ought to do it through the higher ed committee rather than the tax bill. But I really do think we need to think about how this would work in real-world circumstances, and we might have some unanticipated impacts because we have some really clever young people who would figure out the ins and outs of this, just like we had a very smart young man in front of us who created his Buy Me, in capital M-E, business using angel investment tax credits. And I suspect most people his age have never heard of or thought much about tax credits.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And this bill did go through the Higher Ed Committee. It was discussed there. Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I guess I'd like to add that the third bullet point is the one that's intended to keep someone from making a, you know, getting it all at one time. So if you had undergraduate loans of, say, $20,000 and you had a very low income and you were able to borrow that money from your, you know, from your parents in order to pay them off, you would still be limited to the amount of interest that you actually paid on the loan during the tax year plus 10% of the principal. So the 10% of the principal would be $2,000, and then the interest would be whatever you had actually paid during the year to service the loan. So it wouldn't be, you wouldn't be getting the whole $20,000 paid for under the catch of that third bullet point.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing I think we should think about if we're going to do a higher ed policy in the tax committee is that the majority of people choose to invest their career in the last school that they attended. So if we're going to be subsidizing undergraduate or graduate school, we might want to think about whether or not this is for students who are in Minnesota or if we want to put some preferences there.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Okay, before we do anything with this bill, for tomorrow's meeting, we have House File 1628, Quam 1704. How do you say this? It's Joaquim, 1985, who? Easier name, Lincheski. Okay, 2017 McDonald, 2019 McDonald, 2134 Knobloch, 1470 Garofalo. Any further discussion on House File 2084? With that, I'll move that House File 2084 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. With that being said, is there anything else for the good of the order? Okay, thank you for your work today, members. Don't stop believing. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.